Have you ever stopped to think about just how, well, incredible the human body is and how resilient?
It really is something, constantly working, adapting.
Exactly, doing all these vital jobs behind the scenes. But what happens when those key systems, the quiet ones, suddenly face, serious challenges?
That's a crucial question.
So today, that's what we're doing, taking a deep dive right into that, our mission. To focus on some really key health conditions, problems with the liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and even specific cancer-related emergencies.
Right.
We want to cut through all the complexity, give you the most important info from our sources, and help you feel genuinely informed without, drowning in medical jargon.
And I think that's so valuable because what's really fascinating is how interconnected these organs are. They don't work in isolation.
Not at all.
So understanding how they function, and maybe more importantly, what happens when things go wrong, well, that can give you some real aha moments about your overall health, how it all fits together.
Absolutely. So by the end of our chat today, our objective for you listening in is to have a much clearer picture of how these diseases affect the body, what signs to maybe look out for, how doctors figure them out, and the main ways they're managed. Ready to jump in?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's start with the liver. You could really call it one of the body's unsung heroes, couldn't you?
Oh, definitely. It does so much. Over 500 vital jobs.
Like detoxifying blood, making proteins. It's fundamental, which is why liver problems, well, they can ripple outwards, affect so many other systems. So hepatic disorders are our starting point.
Indeed. And when we want to see how the liver's doing, we look at several key lab values. Blood tests, basically. Think of them like the liver's performance report.
Okay.
So, for instance, alanine aminotransferase, ALT,
Oh, yeah.
if that's up higher than the normal range, it often points to some kind of liver inflammation or damage, general issue.
ALT, got it.
Then there's aspartate aminotransferase, AST, that can also be increased in things like cirrhosis, hepatitis, or even liver cancer. We also look closely at gamma-glutamyl transferase, GGT. An increase there is often particularly linked to alcoholic liver disease or problems with the bile ducts.
Okay, GGT.
And beyond those enzymes, we check clotting factors, PTI and R. If the liver isn't working well, it doesn't make enough clotting proteins, so blood takes longer to clot, the PTI and R gets prolonged.
Right, longer clotting time.
And of course, bilirubin, if that's increased, well, that's when we often see jaundice.
So these blood tests really paint a picture, but it's not just blood tests, right? There are other tools.
Correct. We also use things like liver biopsy, ultrasound, CT scans, MRI. But you're right, it's not just the tests and images.
Yeah.
A really thorough assessment is key. We need the patient's history. Any exposure to liver-damaging stuff, alcohol, drugs, and a physical exam looking for subtle things like skin changes or even checking their cognitive status, their thinking.
That makes sense. It's the whole picture.
Exactly. And when we talk about common liver problems, we see things like cirrhosis, that's scarring of the liver, can be acute or chronic, infections like hepatitis, and something we're seeing more and more of, fatty liver disease.
Fatty liver disease.
Yeah, which includes NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, basically just fat buildup, but also NANASH-H, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, that's more serious, where the fat causes inflammation and damages liver cells.
Okay. And you mentioned jaundice earlier. That's one of the really visible signs, isn't it? The manifestations can be quite, well, striking.
They certainly can be. Jaundice is probably the most obvious, that yellow or greenish color in the skin and eyes.
Yeah.
It happens when bilirubin gets above 2 mL
Right.
GDL. And we often distinguish between two main types. Hepatocellular jaundice means the liver cells themselves are sick. So you might see symptoms like poor appetite, nausea, vomiting, weight loss, just feeling unwell, tired. Maybe chills or fever if there's an infection.
Okay, hepatocellular.
Then there's obstructive jaundice. That's when bile flow is blocked. The signs are different. Dark, orange-brown urine, pale or clay-colored stools.
Clay-colored. Wow.
Yeah. And trouble digesting fats, plus often intense itching pruritus because bile salts build up in the skin.
So those different symptoms, the colors, they really point towards the type of liver issue. What's another major complication we see?
Another big one is portal hypertension.
Portal hypertension.
Yes, think of blood flowing through the liver like cars on a highway. If there's a blockage, maybe from cirrhosis, you get a traffic jam. Pressure builds up in the whole portal venous system. That's the network of veins leading to the liver.
Okay, like a bottleneck.
Exactly. And that high pressure directly leads to two other serious problems, ascites and esophageal varices.
Ah, ascites. That's the fluid accumulation in the abdomen, right? I imagine that can get quite pronounced.
It really can. So the portal hypertension causes that backup, increasing pressure in the abdominal blood vessels. But also, a failing liver doesn't handle the hormone aldosterone properly, so the body holds on to extra fluid. And, crucially, it struggles to make enough albumin. Albumin is a protein that acts like a sponge, keeping fluid inside blood vessels. When albumin levels drop, fluid leaks out into the abdomen. That's ascites.
So multiple factors contributing to that swelling.
Yes. When we assess for it, we measure abdominal girth, track weight, look for stretch marks, maybe distended veins on the belly or an umbilical hernia. Treatment starts conservatively. Low sodium diet, maybe restricting fluids.
And if that's not enough,
then we might need paracentesis, draining the fluid with a needle. Sometimes giving IV albumin helps.
Yeah.
Or more invasive procedures like a TIPSS shunt.
TIPSS.
Transjugular intrahepatic portosystemic shunt. It basically creates a detour for blood flow, bypassing the liver blockage to relieve pressure. Or sometimes a peritoneal shunt.
Complex stuff. And then there's hepatic encephalopathy. That sounds like it affects the brain.
It does. It's very serious. Hepatic encephalopathy happens when the liver is too sick to remove ammonia from the blood properly. Ammonia is toxic to the brain.
So it builds up.
Exactly. It accumulates in the brain. We might see changes on an EEG, altered consciousness, confusion, sleepiness, even coma, potential seizures too. And sometimes a distinctive breath odor, kind of sweet and musty, called fetor hepaticus.
Fetor hepaticus.
Yeah. Treatment focuses on, well, first addressing the underlying cause if possible, then using things like lactulose and a medication that binds ammonia in the gut so it gets eliminated in stool. 4-EV glucose can help minimize the body breaking down protein and reducing ammonia coming from the gut with things like gastric suction, enemas, or certain antibiotics.
Okay. And one more really dangerous outcome from severe liver disease, esophageal varices.
Yes. Perhaps one of the most immediately life-threatening. These are basically swollen, very fragile veins in the esophagus, like varicose veins, but in the esophagus.
And they form because of the portal hypertension.
Exactly. That back pressure forces blood into smaller veins that aren't meant to handle it, like those in the esophagus. They occur in a lot of patients with cirrhosis, maybe up to 60% in advanced cases. And the scary part is, the first time they bleed, the mortality rate is high, like 10-30%.
Wow. That's incredibly high.
What are the warning signs?
Alarming signs include hemodiamnesis, vomiting blood, melena, those dark, teary stools from digested blood, just a general rapid decline in condition, and signs of shock, like low blood pressure, rapid heart rate.
So an emergency.
Absolutely. Management is immediate. 4-E fluids, blood transfusions, medications to reduce blood flow to the area, like vasopressin or octreotide, or drugs like propranolol to lower the portal pressure itself.
And interventions.
Yes. Procedures like balloon tamponade to apply pressure directly to the bleeding varices. EGD, that's endoscopy, to see the bleeding and treat it directly, maybe with sclerotherapy, injecting something to shrink the veins, or variceal ligation, putting tiny bands around them. And sometimes the TIPSS procedure we mentioned earlier can help in the long run. That's a really thorough and, yeah, a bit sobering look at the liver. It really highlights how central it is and how its problems cascade. But moving on to digestion, we can't forget its neighbors, the gallbladder and pancreas. They send their own distress signals, right?
They definitely do. Let's start with the gallbladder. A common issue is cholecystitis. That's inflammation of the gallbladder. It can be acute or chronic.
Okay, cholecystitis, what does that feel like?
Typically pain, tenderness, maybe rigidity in the upper right side of the abdomen. Sometimes it radiates to the right shoulder or back.
And there are different types.
Yes. Most common is calculus cholecystitis. That's where a gallstone blocks the bile outflow from the gallbladder. Bile builds up, causes inflammation, pressure. It can even damage the gallbladder wall, potentially leading to gangrene.
Caused by a stone. What's the other type?
A calculus cholecystitis. That's inflammation without a stone blocking things.
Yeah.
We tend to see this in patients who are already very ill, maybe after major trauma, surgery, or severe burns. The exact mechanism isn't always clear, but it involves gallbladder stasis and ischemia.
Okay. And closely related is cholecystitis itself, right? The gallstone.
Exactly. Cholecystitis just means gallstones, two main kinds, pigment stones and cholesterol stones. Cholesterol stones are more common in Western countries.
And who gets them? I think I've heard of risk factors.
Ah, yes. The classic mnemonic, the four Fs. Risk is higher if you're fat, female, 40 or older, and fertile, related to estrogen levels, though, of course, anyone can get them.
The four Fs, okay. And what are the symptoms? Do people always know they have them?
Not always. Some people have gallstones and never know it, silent stones. But if they cause problems, symptoms can range from mild indigestion to severe pain, often called biliary colic.
Biliary colic.
Yeah, it's usually a steady, moderate to severe pain in the upper right abdomen that can last for minutes to hours. It often happens after eating, especially fatty foods. Other signs can include jaundice, if a stone blocks the main bile duct, which would also cause dark urine or those clay-colored stools we talked about. Mm. And sometimes deficiencies in fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, K, because proper bile flow is needed to absorb them.
So if someone does have symptomatic gallstones, what's the management plan? Does diet play a big role?
Diet is definitely important, especially during an acute attack or leading up to treatment. Initially, it might involve resting the bowel, maybe IV fluids, NPO, nothing by mouth, possibly a nasogastric tube for suction. Pain meds and antibiotics if there's infection are key.
And the diet itself.
Longer term, and especially after an acute episode, the recommendation is generally a low-fat diet. Think cooked foods, rice, lean proteins, mashed potatoes, veggies that don't cause gas, bread, coffee, tea. Basically easier to digest foods.
What should be avoided?
Definitely things that can trigger gallbladder contraction or are high in fat. Eggs, cream, pork, fried foods, rich pastries, alcohol, and gas-forming vegetables like cabbage or beans are often on the avoid list.
Okay. And beyond diet, medical treatments.
Yes. ERCP, that endoscopic procedure, can be used not just for diagnosis, but also to remove stones from the bile duct or place stents. There are some medications, like ursodeoxycholic acid, that can dissolve certain types of cholesterol stones. But it takes a long time, and it isn't suitable for everyone.
And surgery.
Surgery is very common, especially laparoscopic cholecystectomy, removing the gallbladder through small incisions. It's highly effective. For people who can't have surgery, there are other options like dissolving stones via direct contact or lithotripsy, using shockwaves to break them up, but surgery is generally preferred, if possible.
Makes sense. Okay, that covers the gallbladder pretty well. Now, the pancreas. You said people don't think about it much until it causes that excruciating pain.
That's usually the case, unfortunately. We're talking mainly about acute pancreatitis. It's a serious inflammation of the pancreas.
What causes it?
Often the pancreatic duct gets blocked, maybe by a gallstone passing through, or sometimes due to heavy alcohol use, among other causes. When it's blocked, the digestive enzymes the pancreas makes get trapped inside. Yeah. Instead of flowing into the intestine to digest food, they back up and start, well, auto-digesting the pancreas itself.
Digesting itself. Ouch.
Exactly. Leading to intense inflammation, swelling, and pain. The hallmark symptom is severe abdominal pain, often radiating straight through to the back. It frequently comes on suddenly, maybe after a large meal or drinking alcohol.
What other signs are there?
Abdominal distension, maybe bruising around the belly button or flank area. That's a sign of bleeding behind the abdominal lining. Nausea, vomiting are very common, fever, jaundice sometimes, confusion, low blood pressure, fast heart rate. Even respiratory distress can occur in severe cases.
How is it diagnosed, besides the symptoms?
Lab tests are crucial. We look for sky-high levels of amylase and lipase. Those are the pancreatic enzymes that leak into the blood. Normal amylase is around 2385, lipase 0160 UUL. In pancreatitis, they can be many times higher. Imaging like CT, MRI, or ultrasound helps visualize the pancreas and look for complications. Complete blood count, too.
And how do you manage someone with acute pancreatitis? It sounds like they need to be in the hospital.
Oh, absolutely. Management focuses on relieving symptoms and preventing or treating complications. The cornerstone is resting the pancreas completely. That means NPO, nothing by mouth. Sometimes for days.
Nothing by mouth at all.
Correct. They get IV fluids for hydration and nutrition if needed. Medications to reduce stomach acid, like histamine 2 antagonists, are often used. Pain control is critical, usually requires strong opioids, antiemetics for nausea and vomiting, and very close monitoring.
Why such close monitoring? What are the risks?
Because acute pancreatitis can lead to really serious complications.
Mm-hmm.
Severe fluid and electrolyte shifts, parts of the pancreas dying off, necrosis, which can get infected, leading to shock, multiple organ failure, or DIC, that widespread clotting problem. It can be very dangerous.
Wow. Okay. We've covered a lot with the liver, gallbladder, and pancreas, serious conditions. But you mentioned another category often linked to cancer, oncologic emergencies.
Yes. These are acute, sometimes sudden, potentially life-threatening problems that can happen, either because of the cancer itself or sometimes as a result of its treatment. They require urgent recognition and management.
Okay, let's break those down. What's the first one?
Let's start with superior vena cava syndrome, or SVCS.
Superior vena cava. That's a major vein.
Yes, it's the large vein that brings deoxygenated blood from the head, neck, arms, and upper chest back to the heart. In SVCS, a tumor, often lung cancer, lymphomas are also common culprits, presses on or grows into the SVC, blocking blood flow.
So like a dam effect.
Exactly. Blood backs up. The manifestations can be pretty dramatic. Shortness of breath is common, cough, maybe hoarseness, or a high-pitched breathing sound called stridor, chest pain, and very noticeable swelling, edema in the face, neck, arms, hands, upper chest.
That sounds quite visible.
It is. You might also see difficulty swallowing, neck veins bulging, JVD, dilated veins across the chest wall. In severe cases, it can even increase pressure inside the skull, leading to headaches, vision changes, or altered mental status.
How is SVCS managed?
The main goal is to relieve the obstruction. Radiation therapy or chemotherapy to shrink the tumor is often primary. Sometimes anticoagulants are used if there's a clot, maybe an intravascular stent placed inside the SVC to prop it open, and supportive care is crucial. Oxygen, raising the head of the bed, sometimes corticosteroids to reduce swelling or diuretics. Diagnostics usually involve imaging like a chest X-ray, CT, or MRI of the chest, and maybe a venogram to see the blockage.
Okay, SVCS, what's the next emergency?
Spinal cord compression. This is another really serious one because it can cause permanent neurological damage if not treated quickly.
What causes it?
It happens when cancer, often cancer that has spread, metastasized to the bones of the spine, grows and compresses the spinal cord itself or the nerve roots coming off it.
Right. What are the signs to look for?
Pain is usually the earliest and most common symptom. Back or neck pain, often localized, maybe worse with movement, coughing, or lying down. There can be inflammation and swelling locally. As it progresses, you see neurological problems, weakness, numbness, tingling, difficulty walking, and eventually loss of bladder or bowel control. This is usually a late and ominous sign.
So pain is a key early warning. How is it diagnosed and treated?
MRI is usually the best diagnostic tool to visualize the compression. CT scans, X-rays, bone scans can also be helpful. Sometimes just tapping gently over the spine can reveal tenderness. Treatment aims to relieve the pressure quickly. High-dose corticosteroids are often given immediately to reduce swelling. Radiation therapy to shrink the tumor is common. Sometimes surgery is needed to remove the tumor, compressing the cord, debulking, or stabilize the spine. Procedures like vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty can help stabilize fractured vertebrae. Chemotherapy might be used depending on the cancer type.
Okay, spinal cord compression. Urgent. What else?
Hypercalcemia. High calcium levels in the blood.
Ah, yes, high calcium. You had a mnemonic for this.
I do. It's really helpful for remembering symptoms of calcium imbalances. Just think, calcemia is due the opposite of the prefix.
Opposite of the prefix. Okay.
So hypercalcemia, calcium is up, means symptoms generally go down, things slow down. Hypocalcemia, calcium is down, symptoms generally go up, things get revved up, like muscle twitching, cramps. Does that help?
That actually clarifies it a lot. So for hypercalcemia, calcium is high, things slow down. What kind of down symptoms are we talking about?
Exactly. So you see fatigue, muscle weakness, confusion, lethargy, decreased responsiveness. Reflexes might be sluggish, hyperreflexia. The gut slows down. Nausea, vomiting, constipation, sometimes a complete bowel stoppage called ileus. Kidneys try to get rid of calcium, leading to increased urination, polyuria, and thirst, polydipsia, which can cause dehydration.
Ah.
And importantly, it can cause heart rhythm problems, arrhythmias.
That sounds like it affects almost everything. Why does it happen in cancer?
It often happens when cancer cells produce substances that stimulate bone breakdown, releasing calcium into the blood, or when cancer directly invades bone. Some cancers produce a hormone-like substance that increases calcium levels. The kidneys just can't keep up with excreting the excess.
How is it managed? It sounds life-threatening.
It can be. Management involves identifying patients at risk, monitoring calcium levels. Treating the underlying cancer is key long-term. But acutely, you need to lower the calcium. The main strategy is aggressive hydration, usually lots of IV fluids, maybe 3 to 4 liters or more initially, to dilute the calcium and help the kidneys flush it out, often followed by diuretics, but only after hydration is restored. Patients should avoid calcium supplements or calcium-rich antacids. Sometimes medications that inhibit bone breakdown, like bisphosphonates or calcitonin, are used.
Aggressive hydration is key. Got it. And the last oncologic emergency.
Tumor lysis syndrome, or TLS.
Tumor lysis, like the tumor breaking apart.
Exactly. It's a potentially fatal complication that happens when a large number of cancer cells die rapidly, often after starting effective chemotherapy or radiation, especially for cancers like leukemia or lymphoma that are very sensitive to treatment.
Why is that dangerous?
When those cells break down, they release all their internal contents into the bloodstream very quickly. This causes a sudden flood of electrolytes and metabolic byproducts. Specifically, you get high potassium, hyperkalemia, high phosphate, hyperphosphatemia, and high uric acid, hyperuricemia, from the breakdown of cellular DNA. These imbalances can overwhelm the body.
Okay, so rapid electrolyte shifts. What does that look like clinically?
It affects multiple systems neurologically. Fatigue, weakness, confusion, muscle cramps, spasms, tetany, tingling numbness, paresthesias, even seizures. Cardiac or liker. High blood pressure, EKG changes, short QT, wide QRS, weird T waves, arrhythmias, potentially cardiac arrest, especially from the high potassium.
Wow.
Gastrointestinal. Loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, cramps, diarrhea.
Renal.
Flank pain, low urine output, oliguria, no urine, anuria. Acute kidney injury, because uric acid and calcium phosphate can crystallize in the kidneys. The urine becomes very acidic. Other signs can include gout flares from the high uric acid, general malaise, itching.
So, a systemic crisis, how is TLS diagnosed and managed?
Diagnosis is based on seeing those specific electrolyte imbalances. High potassium, phosphate, uric acid, often along with low calcium, because phosphate binds with it, and signs of kidney injury like high creatinine. Management is critical and needs to be proactive in high-risk patients. Aggressive 5-E hydration is crucial, even more so than in hypercalcemia, to flush the kidneys. Diuretics might be used. Medications like allopurinol or resveratrol are given to lower uric acid levels.
For high potassium, treatments can include things like polystyrene sulfonate, chiaxylate, to bind potassium in the gut, IV sodium bicarbonate, or infusions of hypertonic dextrose and regular insulin to shift potassium back into cells temporarily. Phosphate binders like aluminum hydroxide might be needed. And if kidney failure develops or electrolytes are dangerously high, hemodialysis is often necessary.
Intense management. Mm-hmm. It really underscores how acute these emergencies are. Phew.
Okay.
We have covered a huge amount of ground today, really diving deep into these complex challenges affecting the liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and then shifting into those critical oncologic emergencies. It's quite a spectrum, isn't it? From chronic issues to sudden life-threatening events.
It really is. And that's exactly the value we hope you, the listener, can take away from this. The goal wasn't to make anyone an expert overnight, but to provide a solid foundational understanding. Giving you vital insights, you know, into recognizing potential symptoms, appreciating how doctors approach diagnosis, and really understanding the urgency and the complexity involved in treating these conditions.
Yeah.
Because that knowledge, ultimately, it empowers you. It helps with proactive health management, and it allows for more informed, meaningful conversations with healthcare providers,
yeah,
whether it's for yourself or someone you care about.
Absolutely. So as you think back on everything we've discussed, all these different organs and emergencies, maybe consider this. Beyond the specific diseases, did you notice any patterns, any recurring themes in how these seemingly diverse conditions can impact multiple body systems, how one problem can trigger another? And maybe think about how that interconnectedness could shape your own perspective on, well, maintaining overall wellness and perhaps being more attuned to subtle changes in your health, something to reflect on.